You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 282 by Rudolf Steiner, a cycle of lectures entitled Speech and Drama. This is the beginning of Part 2, Lectures 8 through 14, entitled The Art of Production and the Art of Acting. Lecture 8, entitled The Molding and Sculpting of Speech, given on the 12th of September, 1924. My dear friends, we will begin today with a recitation given by Frau Dr. Steiner, which will, I think, bring home to you with added force all that we have been considering in the last lectures. For the scene that will be read provides excellent opportunity for showing how one who seriously wants to be an artist in his work on the stage can find the way to a right forming of his speech. Whether or no we attain to this depends in great measure upon our ability to effect a certain inner adaptation of our speaking, so that it may truly have the qualities both of sculpture and of painting. We shall very likely have some trouble in getting rid of what might well be called the grayness of speech that is only too common on the stage today. I mean the speech that is content to remain at the prosaic level of the speaking we use in everyday life. We shall really have to bestir ourselves to effect a reform in this direction. For this latest phase in the development of acting is taking us farther and farther away from art. It seems indeed to be the aim and object of the modern actor to speak without any art at all, employing as he does for the stage merely the speaking of ordinary everyday intercourse. Judged from the standpoint of naturalism, the acting profession of the present day has undoubtedly succeeded in achieving a very high standard. The achievement, however, has nothing artistic about it. On many occasions during recent years, I have been utterly amazed at the naturalistic performances I have witnessed on the stage. Again and again one has been confronted with the strange phenomenon of a play being acted without the least attempt to develop a style that could lift the performance to the level of art. One has had, on the contrary, the feeling of being transported into a stark realism of the most everyday description. Needless to say, we do not go to the theater for that. Anyone who looks for nothing else but sheer naturalism in an artistic performance is like a person who doesn't care for a portrait painted by an artist. That doesn't please him at all. He would much rather have a photograph, preferably perhaps a colored one, since he can understand that more readily. But the whole secret of art lies in this. In art we reveal truth by quite other means than nature uses. Nature reveals truth more immediately. Truth must be present in nature, and truth must be present also in art. The truth in nature shines forth to the spirit. From the truth in art, the spirit shines forth. Once we have grasped this fact and made it our own, we shall feel within us an urgent need to discover how art and style can be restored to the stage, and we shall not rest until we find it. I will tell you something that can prove helpful in this connection. Practice bringing your speech organs into a kind of speaking, the very nature and quality of which oblige you to diverge from the naturalistic speaking of everyday intercourse. You will have an example of this in the scene to which we shall presently be listening. The scene is taken from Lessing's play titled Minna von Barnhelm, in which one of the characters, readers aside, forgive my attempt at the French here, Ricard de la Marlinière, is a Frenchman speaking German. It is impossible to speak this part, and it ordinary, everyday manner. One has perforce to give a certain style to the speaking of Ricaud de la Marlinera. He is constantly interposing French words and phrases, and his German has always a French accent. Such a part could well be used as an exercise in the forming of speech. It will help the student to acquire a fluency that has style. This was indeed our reason for choosing the scene. Now, Frau Dr. Steiner speaks. The scene is laid in a room in a hotel. Ricaud de la Marlinera enters, expecting to find there Major Telheim. There's now a quote. Close quote. Dr. Steiner again. And now let us ask ourselves, why do we need speech formation as a special art on its own, within the realm of drama? Suppose you are taking part in a scene where you are engaged in conversation with another actor, and you stand there, listening to him, in just the same way as you would in real life. No one could call that art. In ordinary conversation, we hear the other person's words, but pay hardly any attention at all to the sound of the words or the intonation. We do not stop to appreciate the forming of the speech. In fact, we hear as little of the forming of word or of speech as we see of a transparent pane of glass. We look through the glass to what is behind. And in ordinary life, we look through, or rather hear through, the word. The word has become for us transaudible. We scarcely notice the word itself and the way it is formed. And this is what we must learn to do again. A serious effort must now be made to restore to the art of the stage the hearing of the word. We must not be content merely with looking through the word as one looks at trees through a pane of glass, looking through the word in order to see what the other person means, trying to catch his thought or his feeling or some news he is telling us. We must learn to hear the word itself and experience a real content in this hearing of the word. Thought is, in a way, the death of art. The moment something real that is seeking artistic revelation passes into the realm of thought, art has left it. What art would show forth to us, we must hear, we must see. But now, the art of the stage is concerned with human beings who think and feel. A dramatic performance has to portray human beings. That is its concern. When, however, we form our words so that this formed word manifests itself as having an artistic value of its own, something of the human being is lost in the process. This has to be made up for, and the only way to do it is by mime and gesture. Here, you see, we have reached the moment of transition from the arts of recitation and declamation to the art of acting as such. And this is where we come up against the necessity for a specific and thorough training for the stage. Once again, we can do no more at the moment than put forward a kind of ideal for such a schooling, insofar as mime, gesture, and so on are concerned. For conditions being as they are today, it can be only in the rather distant future that students of dramatic art will be able to receive a training that approaches it. The very cherishing of an ideal, however, the very setting out together in this way to consider what is eventually to be achieved, will help you to go forth in quest of that ideal and to travel as far on the road as the limitations of the present time allow. Let us then put the question, what should a school of dramatic art be like? What form should it take? And here, right at the beginning, let me say a word that will, I hope, remove some misunderstandings. In a school of dramatic art, just because it has to do with living men and women who have their own individual forms of expression, it has necessarily to be a question of educating by means of examples, giving the students indications and directions, but always in such a way that these are understood to be examples single instances out of many. For in everything to do with the stage, the freedom of the artist has to be most strictly respected. It will therefore not be a matter of providing students with instructions that have to be followed with a pedantic adherence to the letter. Advice will be given of a good way in which this or that can be done, and then the students will be left free to form and develop their work in the spirit of the given indications. And this is how I mean you to take the description I shall now give of what should be a first step in preparation for speaking on the stage. At the beginning of this course of lectures, I drew your attention to the gymnastics of the Greeks, showing you how these were developed instinctively from the organism of man. For the five main activities of running, leaping, wrestling, discus throwing, spear throwing, do actually present in a kind of ascending scale activities that the nature of man may be said to require. In order to meet the needs of modern times, there will obviously have to be some modification of the old forms. Nevertheless, we shall get a pretty good idea of how our gymnastics movements should be today if we study these five main activities, thinking of them as ensouled by the Spirit. For so we may truly describe the gymnastics of ancient Greece. They were ensouled by the Spirit. They had something of genius about them, and those who practiced them came under an influence that was genuinely artistic, genuinely spiritual. We have not time now to consider the modifications that might have to be introduced. I think, however, you will grasp the essential point if in making the following suggestions for training, I simply use the terms that belong to the gymnastics of ancient Greece. This, then, is how a training for the stage should begin, with a course of training in gymnastics, given in the spirit of the gymnastics of ancient Greece. The five main exercises, somewhat recast for the present age, should be well and thoroughly practiced: running, leaping, wrestling, throwing the discus or some similar object, throwing the spear or some similar object. Why do I recommend this course in gymnastics? Not in order that the actor may acquire skill in this direction. I have no desire to make an athlete of him. The art of acting, let me tell you, will never attain its true nobility if it is allowed to go the way of Reinhardt and suffer methods of the circus to be brought in. Rather must it free itself entirely from any such connection and go steadily forward in pursuit of its proper aim, namely, the worthy rendering on the stage of the poetry and art that are inherent in true drama. When we say that a training for the stage should begin with gymnastics, we have something altogether different in mind. We are thinking of the need for the forming of the word, to become, in the actor, a complete matter of course, so that it takes place in him instinctively. And the gymnastics can give just the right help to bring this about. Mime and gesture, too, these above all have to become a matter of instinct. They must, of course, avoid being naturalistic. They must have art. They must have style. They must be as though impelled straight from the world of the spirit. And yet they have to become for the actor as spontaneous and unpremeditated as the behavior of ordinary persons in everyday life. Of persons, that is, who are not affected and do not give themselves airs. Who are not affected and do not give themselves airs. With the same natural spontaneity that belongs to everyday life, must the actor be continually giving artistic form to his words, his gestures, his physiognomy. And so, while pursuing his conscious study of the art, the actor should at the same time be experiencing it instinctively. He has to be able to combine the two. While learning it, he must also live it. Otherwise, his words and gestures will constantly give the impression of being artificial. And now, let us say you learn running. then you will be learning how to walk on the stage. That is to say, your walking will give you the right articulation to the word. Running, walking so as to give the right articulation to the word. The spectator has, you see, to understand from gesture and mime what he is not able to receive through his hearing. What the actor speaks, we are to hear. What the actor does, his mime and gesture, that, out of a certain instinct, we are to understand. Their understanding is in place, since there art can enter in. For in ordinary life we do not use mime and gesture, not at all events with conscious intent. By the exercise of leaping, we learn how to modify our walking on the stage. One part of the text will require slow walking, while with another we shall want to walk more rapidly. We learn, in fact, to adapt our walking instinctively to the various ways of speaking, which I described in an earlier lecture, showing you how the word can be incisive, full-toned, or long-drawn out, can be abrupt, or hard, or gentle. Each of these qualities in speaking has to be accompanied by a corresponding modification of walking. On the stage, neither speaker nor listener may walk in an arbitrary manner. The pace has to be learned from the word. According as the word is incisive or full, deliberate, hard or gentle, so must we learn to bring our walking into the right measure, moving now more quickly, now more slowly, reaching even at times that utmost slowness that consists in standing still. And this we acquire instinctively when we practice leaping. Leaping, the adaptation of walking to the character of the spoken word. We touch here a secret of human nature, in so far as human nature may be allowed to have a say in the art of the drama. That the adaptation of walking to the character of the word is instinctively acquired through the exercise of leaping is not a thing one can prove by argument, but only by experience. Put it into practice, and you will find that it is so. There are, I can assure you, many things in life that can only be learned by trying them out, and all the theories people build up concerning them are worth nothing at all. In the exercise of wrestling, one learns how to move one's hands and arms when speaking, again, instinctively. This is best learned from wrestling. Wrestling, hand and arm movements. In the throwing of the discus, where man has to let his gaze follow the direction of the throw, follow the whole path taken by the discus after it is thrown, his look changing, adapting itself to correspond, adapting itself even to the movement of the hand, in discus throwing, paradoxical as it may sound, we learn play of countenance. A play of countenance that comes and goes without effort, implying full control of the facial muscles. This is what can be learned from throwing the discus. It can as well be the throwing of a ball or other similar object. I use, however, the Greek term for the exercise. Discus throwing, play of countenance. Lastly, we come to what may well seem strangest of all. And this, again, can naturally never be proved by argument. It has to be experienced. By practicing throwing the spear, one learns to speak. Sticks can quite well be used instead of spears, but it must be exercised in this kind of throwing. For as we practice spear throwing, our speech acquires the immediate effectiveness that enables it to work as speech, and not as an expression of thought. So, you see, the actor actually requires for his training that he should exercise himself in throwing things like sticks and spears. The alertness and care that are needed for it will draw the speaking away from the intellect and take it right into the speech organs, allowing it to mold and form them. Spear throwing is nothing less than the foundation for speech. Spear throwing, speech. I mean, of course, in the broadest sense. Then we'll follow the specific speech exercises, which we went through earlier on. But if we are envisaging a properly ordered school for dramatic art, we should ensure that our students discover from their own experience that the throwing of long spear-like objects evokes in them an instinctive understanding for what has been given in these lectures in reference to the forming of speech. If all of you sitting here had for a long time been practicing spear throwing, you would be in no doubt at all about the truth of my words. Things of this kind do not admit of theoretical proof. They prove themselves in the doing. The results of such a training will soon show in those who undertake it. Spear throwing provides the exactly right occult training for one who would attain proficiency in stage speaking. So now you can form for yourselves a picture of what the beginner's class in a school for dramatic art should be like. And when, working out of the spirit of the whole, we come to consider the individual student, the human personality who stands before us, as the subject of the art, and begin to study with him all the further details, we shall not communicate these in a dogmatic way as if they were rules, but rather as suggestions. All instruction for the stage must in fact be, as we said before, by way of suggestion and advice. In regard to what he has learned, the would-be actor has to be left absolutely free. He may carry it out precisely as it has been given him, or, on the other hand, he may, working out of the same spirit, do it differently. One of the very first things a student has to learn is that not for a single moment should there be on the stage an unoccupied actor. No one must ever stand on the stage doing nothing. It is distinctly a fault if a moment occurs in a play when one actor is talking and a few others whose presence the scene requires are simply standing about doing nothing at all. The one who is doing the talking, he is talking. The others who are listening must, every one of them, be participating all the time in what he is saying. Suppose there are four actors on the stage and one is speaking. Then the other three should also be acting. They have to play with the speaker, playing in mime and in gesture. This is where the art of production comes in. The producer is responsible for the picture that the stage presents throughout the play, and he must make sure that there is never on the stage an actor who is unoccupied. If an actor were to stand on the stage and listen just as in real life, instead of acting the listening, that would be an artistic fault. Listening on the stage with full inner experience must not be a real listening. It must not be naturalistic. It must be an acted listening. Along with everything else, it has to be drawn into the stream of the acting. And so the listening actor has to try to find at every turn a gesture that can rightly accompany the formed speech of the speaker. Naturalism on the stage has the same effect as marionettes. If we have the impression, as we very often have had in recent times, that the people up there on the stage are successfully evoking the illusion of naturalistic reality, then, judged from an artistic standpoint, they are no more than marionettes, the very antithesis of dramatic art. What is needed is that we should develop an inner perception for certain relationships of mime and gesture to the content of the spoken word. Suppose an actor has something intimate to communicate. The spectator must feel this. He must be able to know at once that information of an intimate nature is being given. He will not feel it if the actor walks backward as he speaks. He will, however, if the actor places himself on the stage so that he can go forward while he is speaking. Whenever you want to suggest intimacy, always move forward, going from the back of the stage in the direction of the footlights. Technical details of this nature are often neglected on quite absurd grounds. I once knew a talented actor whose work on the stage reached a high standard in many respects, but who would not learn his part? He simply did not want to take the trouble. The consequence was he was a continual source of annoyance to the poor producer, for he would say to the other actors, quote, "As for you boys, you can move about the stage or stand just where you like. I am going to plant myself here," close quote. And here was close by the prompter's box. And there he remained, all through the play. In other respects, he was an excellent actor. It is, you see, a matter of actually living all the time in the artistic. We must never forget to be artists. Suppose I have before me a little group of people to whom I am telling something, not now of an intimate nature, but merely by way of information. The spectator must be made to feel that the information is of interest to the others who are listening. How the latter should comport himself, with that we will deal later, for the moment we are concerned with the speaker. If I want the spectator to have the impression that the group of persons to whom I am giving the information are taking it all in, I shall have to move slowly backward within the group. The spectator, seeing this in perspective from his seat in the auditorium, will then feel that the listeners are following me with full understanding. Were I instead to walk straight through my group of listeners in the direction of the audience, the latter would receive the impression that my speaking goes past the listeners completely, that they simply do not understand it. Details of this kind belong to the inner technique of the stage. They are the elements from which we have to form the continually changing picture of the stage. If one drops into one of our modern theaters to see a play, as often as not, it doesn't seem to get anywhere. For this is the sort of thing that is constantly happening. First, one actor will light a cigarette and puff away, then another will do the same, and so it goes on. This lighting of cigarettes is cultivated as an art. Actors acquire a special dexterity in it. I have even observed that people rather like a scene that opens somewhat as follows. An actor comes on the stage and for quite a long time says nothing at all, lets the, in quotes, word retire altogether into the background. He sits down and slowly pulls off one of his boots. He wants to show us in realistic manner that he has come home rather late. Then he puts on a slipper. All this time he has not spoken a single word. He pulls off the other boot and puts on the other slipper, still without speaking a single word. Then he proceeds to take off his coat, walks meanwhile a few steps across the room, as anyone might naturally do, and puts on his dressing gown. Next he goes over to the corner of the room and lights the fire. He doesn't want to be cold, and never yet one word. And so he continues with his preparations for bed. Many different things may take place, of course, between taking off one's boots and turning in, but in order to carry out whatever little play of mime or gesture is involved in all this, what, after all, does the actor require? Certainly no serious study. He will have to be confident that he knows how people behave when they are at home, and then, in addition, he will need a little audacity to display himself doing such commonplace things. That is positively all he will need. A method of this kind can obviously never lead to the development of art on the stage. Under certain conditions, it can have disastrous consequences. If the actors happen never in their lives to have seen what they are supposed to portray, then the result on the stage can be frightful. I recently witnessed a performance where one of the scenes was played at court, and it was only too evident that none of the cast had ever seen a court. We must look such things in the face. To do so will help to give us a true feeling for how things should be done if they are to be done artistically. And you will find that the dramatist and the actor, when both are truly artistic, will agree on this matter. Look at Goethe's best plays. You will not find in them many stage directions, actually as few as ever possible. Turn up title Tasso or title Iphigenia. The actor is left free. And that is right. He needs his freedom. There was a time in Goethe's life when he was in contact with some very good actors, and he learned a great deal from them, helped, of course, by his own powerful artistic urge. Once, when Goethe was beginning, quite in the modern style, to give the actress Corona Schutter some detailed instructions for her part, she is said to have replied, quote, "What you say, sir, is all very well, but it won't do, you know. I shall play the part in the way that suits me." Close quote. And now look, on the other hand, at the stage instructions that you find in modern playwrights, sometimes whole pages of them. It is a perfect misery to have to wade through them. In fact, no sensible person will trouble to do so. He wants it left to him to supply these details out of his own imagination as he reads the play. Yes, we have many such plays today, with their prolonged stage instructions, and here and there a page of text in between. You have but to compare them with Tasso or with Iphigenia to see at once that the art of playwriting has suffered a decline, no less than the art of the stage. Everything the actor has to do must be done instinctively. If he is doing it in obedience to a strict injunction, it will look artificial, it will look studied. You must, however, realize how very much can find its way into the actor's instinct, can become instinctive in him. Think that you have before you the stage and the auditorium. The spectator is sitting there, and he has two eyes. If he had not these two eyes, then all the mime and gesturing of the actor would go for nothing. But now, these two eyes are not just dead things about which we need not concern ourselves. They are alive. And a great deal of what happens on the stage, if it is to be rightly received, must take account of these two eyes. For the remarkable thing is that our eyes are not alike in the way they receive what comes into their field of vision. We are not, of course, generally aware of this in ordinary life, nor is the science that belongs to our age. Nevertheless, it is so. Our two eyes are not alike. The right eye is more competent for understanding what is seen, whereas the left is adapted rather to taking an interest in the object at which we are looking. So this is the way we must think of the spectator as he sits facing the stage. Say you are taking part in a play and have come to a passage where it is particularly important, and your own artistic feeling should tell you so, to succeed in arousing the spectator's interest. You will then need to walk as actor from left to right. This will mean that the eye of the spectator, as it follows you going, for him in this direction, to the left, will receive the impression of something that is interesting to him. If the passage in question is rather long, the actor will find it a good plan to go also backward. The interest can quite well weaken a little without hurt. And there's a drawing. This is simply a technique of the stage to meet the requirements of the eyes. But now suppose I have a passage where there is not the same call to stimulate the interest and feelings of the spectator, but where I want to appeal directly to his understanding, where I want perhaps to discuss or argue, as may often happen in a play. In this case, I shall have to move in the opposite direction from him, that is to say, as seen from the stage. I shall have to go from right to left. These are things that need to be known. An actor should know how disturbing it is for the spectator if, when the words he speaks are intended to awaken interest, he moves in this direction. There's an arrow pointing to the right, as seen from the audience. It will mean that no interest will be awakened in the spectator. His interest will, however, be awakened when the actor goes for his view in this direction to the left, as seen from the audience. These things simply are so, and they have to be felt. They have to be experienced, like everything else in art. If we are once able to look with this kind of insight upon all the details of stage management, then we can work in perfect freedom, working out of the spirit, at the arrangement of our scenes. Suppose that at a certain moment in a scene someone comes in with a message. If I let him approach quite slowly, his arms hanging at his side, and go right up to the person to whom he is to deliver the message, before he begins to speak, parenthesis, I am not inventing. I have seen this kind of thing over and over again, close parenthesis. Then, so far as the spectator is concerned, there has been no message at all. If, however, the messenger begins to speak from as far away as possible, speaking also rather loud, louder than his fellow actors, then he does bring a message. As he comes nearer, he can draw back his head a little. That will create the impression that he knows very well what he has to say. And if he brings good news, he may add the gesture of holding up the right hand with fingers outstretched. As a matter of fact, all that I have been saying applies to a message of good news. If it were a case of bad news, the messenger would have to comport himself differently. He would have to come in slowly, as though unwillingly, and then suddenly stop short, and with tightly clenched hands deliver his message. The actor will, of course, be free to modify all this as he feels right, but he must at all events not make this gesture, hands crossed on the breast. These are some of the things into which one is gradually to work one's way. I give them as examples and intend them to be received as such, not as instructions. As we have seen, all training for the stage should be of this character. What the student has to receive is by no means a set of rules. Rather, is his training intended to have a stimulating effect upon his own activity. Particular instances are put before him, which are then capable of manifold variation. The end of Lecture 8.